Out. And there we are. As I pour myself a bottle cocktail shop Negroni, I did have a cheeky taste yesterday. Perhaps, Kieran, you could tell the listeners how you managed to scale the dizzy heights of fame and success to finally make it onto the Philadelphia.
Yeah, so my whole background actually is in hospitality itself. So Phil, you're probably used to back in the day in Ireland in a little country town, you would normally pull pints when you're 14 or 15.
I did. So
that's how I fell in love with it. I originally born and bred in Dublin. We moved down to a little place in Ireland called Wexford when I was about 8 years of age. And then just kind of fell into hospitality. Just started as a busboy in one of the local nightclubs. Then end up behind the bar in a little village pouring pints. And I just fell in love with the craft. I just fell in love with hospitality and just giving people a good experience rather than the pouring a drink or making a gin and tonic. That was my love of it. And then it kind of just went from there. Went to graduated school, decided to study hospitality management in Dublin Institute of Technology. From there, moved over to New York. I worked in the Fitzpatrick Hotel for about 2 months, didn't really like that. It was a small environment. So applied for the Waldorf Astoria and was in the Waldorf Astoria for 2.5 years. So I kind of have a back way of getting back into, back into bars. When I was in college, I worked for the Shelburne in Dublin for 4.5 years. So I was in their number 27 cocktail bar, then the Horseshoe Bar, which is their whiskey bar. Left them when I was a supervisor of the number 27, and that's when I went to New York. Got hired from the Waldorf Astoria as rooms division manager and did that role for about just over a year. So that kind of encompassed like front of desk, housekeeping, concierge, valet. So it was quite a big role. And then from there, went to the managing director at the time, who was an Irish guy by the name of Dermot, who's now the area GM for all of the Hiltons in New York. Sat down with him and just said to him, I said, look, I know the management of rooms inside out. What I'm lacking is management experience when it comes to F&B. I said, I have the practical experience in terms of being a bartender, a waiter, a bar back, I said. But at that time, my goal was to be a GM of a hotel. So for me, it was like, to be a good GM, you need to have encompassing of both rooms and F&B. So he said, yeah, no problem. He goes, I'll give you, it won't be a promotion. Let's just call it like a cross promotion. And I became the conference and banking manager of the Waldorf Astoria. So great experience, the only three-tiered ballroom on the East Coast of America, 80,000 square feet of event space. Did some magical dinners in there. The one that sticks out the most was every 4 years, the Waldorf, obviously is still closed at the minute, used to host the presidential dinners for the elects. So hosted the dinner for Trump and Hillary Clinton. So that was quite eye-opening in terms of like, it was basically a roast. They just got up on stage and roasted each other in front of New York's elites for 2 hours. So yeah, it was quite interesting. And then obviously the hotel got bought by a Chinese investment firm called Ang Bang Insurance. So was part of the closing down team in the Waldorf. Stevie Wonder did the last ever event in the Waldorf. Wow. Played. It was like some of the stories I have from that place is mental. But yeah, he played us out on the very last night. I think it was for New York Presbyterian Hospital, I think the event was for, if my memory serves me correct. And then from there, I was actually getting hired by Sheraton Times Square for my H-1B visa. But obviously Trump got into election and threatened to double the salary of a foreigner on a H-1B visa to stop them taking Americans' jobs. So I found myself back in Ireland for 6 months, worked for the Clifford Lines. And then the Dorchester tried to headhunt me when I was leaving New York, and I turned them down. And then I actually went to London just on a visit, called into the Dorchester, got offered a job there on the spot by the person that I turned it down. So yeah, that was my way back into London, accepted that, did the Dorchester for a year. And then with my ex-business partner, co-founded Homeboy for about 4.5 years and ran it, obviously got top 4 best new international cocktail bar, Tales of the Cocktail. Finished in top 50 every year I ran it. Top 50 UK, that is, not top 50 best bars. And then, yeah, about a year and a half ago, decided to open the bottle cocktail shop and bar. And that's where we are today.
Yeah, so much for the elevator fucking pitch. Jesus Christ.
You said tell us everything. You know, I shortened it down as much as I could.
That's the short version? Holy fuck.
Yes, the short version.
I detect a north side accent. Am I right?
No, you're not actually. It's more southwest, I'd say. Tala accent.
Oh, Jesus. That's awful, man.
Yeah, I know. God bless me for my sins.
I mean, it's got better, but Tala was like Fort Apache, the Bronx. I used to be a motorcycle courier, and I did customs clearance. So I spent my life shuttling around various warehouses. And Tala was the place where you just like sped up when you're going through it.
You know, you're right. Like my mom and dad are from Walkinstown, so they're from St. Peter's Road.
That's
they're,
even worse.
They're childhood sweethearts, so they used to live across the road from each other. And then I was actually, believe it or not, I was born in the Coombe, and then I was christened. We used to live in Blessington in Kildare, so I was christened in Blessington. And then when I was about 2, we moved to Tala, and then when I was 8, we moved down to Wexford, and we've been there ever since.
Yeah, I mean, the only place worse than that is Kilbarrack, Barrytown.
Come on, Tala wasn't Tala. Oh, you just didn't go into Jobstown in Tala. That was it. That was it. We were on Belgard Road. Yeah, it's to be fair. I haven't been out of home. I've been out of Ireland since I was 20. I'm 31 now, so 11 years.
Janie Mac, and yeah. Tell us when you graduated. Was that what used to be the DIT?
Dublin now it's called Dublin Technological University. So they merged Tala IT, DIT, and there was one more, one more anyway, and they merged them all together. Now it's DTU. Yeah, it was supposed to turn into DTU the last year I was there, but the year, 2 years after I graduated, it turned into DTU.
Yeah, because always the hospitality was centered around Cahill Brua Street.
Exactly. That's exactly where it was.
Yeah, and technically I graduated from that institution, but my degree was from Trinity.
Wow.
I still had to pay the fee to go and visit Trinity like anyone else. We didn't actually study there. We studied in a building that was condemned when we moved into it in Mountjoy Square. It was the College of Marketing and Design.
Okay.
Ironically, it also had the bar school in it, and I knew the professors and whatnot, but I've been bartending since the age of 15, so I thought, nothing for me to learn there. Just completely.
Yeah, exactly, right?
But tell us, how did you, you did the proper degree. And I actually, more than 30% of our listeners are American. And you will have noticed, I'm not saying they don't do hotel management degrees here. They, of course, do. And the most famous place is, of course, Cornell University in upstate New York.
Yeah.
But not to the same degree that you do it in Europe. Like, the best hotel schools are the European ones. People talk about Lausanne in Switzerland. There's 5 excellent ones in the Netherlands.
Yeah, Netherlands. You have Shannon in Ireland, which is top tier as well.
Yeah, but this is like, I had a girlfriend once before I was married. Just want to be clear about that. Because have you met my wife? Jesus Christ. And she just refused to believe that you could actually do a degree in hotel management. She thought it was absurd. She was Canadian. And I explained to her once, we were in Las Vegas, and I'm like, well, look at that, you know, $100 million casino hotel resort. There's a general manager in there somewhere, and he did not work his way up by washing dishes. Yeah. No, it's like a huge.
Yeah.
So, is that how you got a visa for the US, or was it a H-1 visa?
Yeah, that's exactly how I got a visa. So for me, I remember my first experience of the States was when I was a kid. I must have been about 10 or 11, you know, your parents bring you to Universal Studios and Disney. So that was my first taste of it. And I always remember just falling in love with America. I don't know what it was about it, but I always had that thing as a kid. And I said to myself, like, if there's ever a way that I can get into the States, I'm going to get in. But for me, it was definitely career led in the sense of when I was graduating from college, it was obviously at that time, I was 19 and 20. So my career aspirations, because I was so embedded within hotels, was to be a hotelier and be a general manager. So I said to myself, well, the trends always start in America first when it comes to hotels and then filter across the Atlantic into Europe. I said, so to get ahead of the curve, because America is always about 5 years ahead, I said, let's go to the States, grab all the knowledge I can grab from the States and then bring it back to Europe with me. And when I go back to Europe, it will stand me in good steads. But I have to say, still, when I came back to America, to Europe 3 years after living in New York, there is a massive disparity between how America operates in terms of hotels and how Ireland and Europe operate in terms of hotel. In a sense, within New York, especially in the Waldorf, it was sink or swim. You got 2 weeks training and then they threw you in at the deep end. And if you swam, you got rewarded. They didn't care about your age. If you're good at your job and you can do your job, then you're doing your job. It's complete opposite over in Europe, I would have to say. And I noticed it when I went back to Ireland for 6 months and when I worked in the Dorchester for a year. Yes, even though you had all the accreditations on your CV and you worked in some of the world's best five-star hotels, if you were young, that hindered you in getting the next position because they would look at you and go, well, you don't have a full-fledged experience. You need to be X age to be a director or so on and so forth. So that was the two disparities I seen between both. And I have to say, like, and I still say to this day, the Waldorf Astoria projected my career by 10 years. You know, that kind of way?
Yeah, I mean, it's a bigger discussion, but I've got a drink in my hand, so grand. It's the sink or swim nature of American capitalism.
Yeah.
In that you do the job, you get the reward. But if you don't, you'll literally be fired on the spot. And it doesn't matter if you're a CEO making $100 million a year or if you're the barback in a dodgy bar in East Harlem. I think it does produce amazing results, right?
Yeah, you know, 100%. Like,
Elon Musk wouldn't be Elon Musk without the USA. And that's something that he himself says. But it doesn't produce overall happy, productive nations, right? America probably needs a few more safeguards on it. But for somebody who wants to get ahead in their career and turbocharge it, especially in hospitality, I think you're absolutely right. There's a few bells and whistles on this one, though. So the Waldorf was a union shop. No, it was a unionized place.
Massive union hotel. So New York, Chicago, Boston, I think LA are the biggest union states within the states. I have to say, the union had the Waldorf by its balls.
Everywhere.
Outrageous. So for example, I'll give you a quick example. So in housekeeping, when we were in the rooms division manager, you would have four different types of you'd have two different types of housekeeper, right? So you'd have you'd have a deep clean houseman that would go into your room and deep clean it. You'd have a corridor houseman that was just in charge of cleaning the corridors. You'd have a speciality houseman that was just in charge of cleaning the chandeliers and some speciality bits. And then you had a window houseman that was in charge of cleaning the windows, right? If I said to one, hey, can you just go out to that corridor? Say a speciality houseman, I said, hey, can you just go out to that corridor and clean the tops of them picture frames and that chandelier for me? And they went, yeah, and when you were young, when you didn't know the rules inside out, they'd catch you out. They'd be like, yeah, sure, no worries. They go do that, report it to the union delegate. Then you go downstairs, the union delegate would be like, you're after making this person do a job that wasn't his, and you're after taking work away from this person that it was. So not only do you have to pay that person 8 hours for giving them extra work, you need to pay that other person 8 hours for taking the work away from them. And you're like, what is this? It's crazy.
Same. The old, it's now the Ned, but when the Nomad Hotel was the Nomad Hotel in New York City and it fucking rocked like a motherfucker, what most people don't know is that the hotel operation was the Ace Hotel, right? Which is not uncommon. The F&B operation was the lads from 11 Madison Park. The hotel operation was the Ace, and it was union. So me and my wife staycations in the hotel on more than one occasion, and like, if the lads in the bar wanted to send us up, like, you know, two bottled Manhattans, right? They had to pay the room service waiter some absurd amount, like $40, in order that they might deliver it themselves. Because the guys were not going to deliver it anyway. Perhaps the best, you know who Audrey Saunders is of the Pegu Club. She did the first kind of groundbreaking consultant update for Bemelman's Bar in the Carlisle,
okay,
which is maybe the most famous union house in New York City. They've got bartenders who've been there for 45 years, and they're all awesome, actually. They're really, really great. But when she was the consultant, and this is going back almost a couple of decades now, she wasn't even allowed to step foot behind the bar.
Wow.
Yeah, I was at a pop-up, the first one ever in their history, and maybe the last one too, where Dante bartenders came in and popped up from 2 to 5 p.m. last week for 3 days in a row, and it was absolutely magical. And the Bellman's bartenders were very gracious and lovely. And it was just amazing to be in that room.
Yeah.
It probably confused the fuck out of their regular customers.
Yeah, what's going on? Yeah. What's the takeover?
Yeah, what's a pop-up? Why is my bartender a quarter the age of Luis, who's been looking after me for 40 years?
Yeah.
When it's wild. You must have worked in the Waldorf with my friend, the friendly bear himself, Frank Caiafa.
I did work with Frank Caiafa. Yeah. So actually, myself and Frank's path would only cross once or twice because obviously he was in charge of Peacock Alley and the bars. And at that time, I was looking after the beverage in C&B. But the last time we still kind of keep in contact through LinkedIn and Facebook. But the last time I bumped into Frank was when we got nominated at Tales of the Cocktail, and I was having a Ramos in the Waldorf in New Orleans. And I looked over to the corner. I was like, Frank, he was like, what are you doing here? I was like, oh, my bar's up for an award. He was like, what? Yeah, he's a great guy.
Oh, he's straight out of Central Casting. He was texting me only this morning. He's actually now a spirits portfolio manager. He's taken on this excellent, it's a fine wine company that, you know, put their hand on Frank's shoulder one day and said, will you build the spirits book? So he's got brilliant stuff in his portfolio, like Oscar 697 Vermouth and all that. So I get to see him all the time because we.
I actually have the version of the Waldorf Astoria cocktail book that he wrote up in Pride and Place on the shelf with all the books like Death and Co and all in the bar. So yeah, he's a good lad.
Yeah, now hopefully the hotel will reopen sooner rather than later in Peacock Alley
this year. I think
it's been this year for a few years.
Yeah, it was supposed to be three, and then I'm out of London. Oh no, I'm out of New York. I'm nearly in London 7 years now. So, yeah, it's been nearly 7.5 years since the place closed down. It's crazy.
That's mad. It's mad, but that's another story. And mm-hmm. Yeah, returning to the theme of where you go further and faster. When I was a young man and I moved from Dublin to London, I was like, "Well, this is it. This is the land of opportunity," right?
Yeah.
And I experienced there what you experienced later on in New York, in that I went for a job. This is very funny. I'd go to Denmark Street Job Center when the jobs were still on these little note cards. And you'd see, right, live-in bartender, you'd live above the pub, and you get X amount of money and whatnot. And I went for one job interview near Hyde Park Corner, and it was a really cool place. Now, this would be 1993-ish or 92-ish maybe.
92, I was one.
Yeah, we don't need to actually say that. Our audience aren't interested in numbers, Ciarán. Your youth is something I won't use against you.
Yeah.
I like to think I'm an example and not a warning. So there I was.
100%.
There I was in London. And I went for a job and I worked a shift. And this place was cool. You know, like they had Moosehead Canadian beer and they had what was then called Rebel Yell Bourbon. Now that was mega cool back then. And they had a really great mix of people coming in. So I went back the next day. And the owner, who was, true story, a retired prostitute named Christine, Irish, obviously. And she said, well, look, I was at the time, by the way, you know, 16. And she says, well, look, what's happened is the head barman has run away with the barmaid and the takings. So I'd like you to be the manager. And when you're 16, especially if you're a 16-year-old male, you have no fucking idea. You're literally the stupidest organism on two legs. And I'm like, absolutely. Yeah. So I lived in above this pub. And I actually became a licensee at the ripe old age of 17 in London.
I love it.
Back when you had to stand up in court. And they'd ask you a few trick questions like, you know, what's the minimum age for drinking alcohol in a pub? And at the time, I know it's changed now, you could actually drink English bitter at the age of 15, right?
Oh, wow.
So that, yeah. They fixed that one pretty quickly.
Yeah, just a bit.
But yeah, London was that place of opportunity and of standing out a little bit, and it was cool to be Irish, right? They'd begun to forget about the IRA, fortunately.
So, yeah, I was about to say.
I mean, bit of a sore point, and you got to give them some credit there.
But yeah, it's like that. That's a brilliant story. It's like the phrase who I think Richard Branson said it is like, if you get asked to do a job that you don't know how to do, accept it and learn on the job.
Honestly, yeah, it's a major difference between men and women. Like my wife was, you know, diving deep into learning about diversity and equity 6-7 years ago. And she told me about one report. It's like the statistic of women won't apply for a job until they're like overqualified, sometimes absurdly so. Whereas men will apply for jobs that they have no shot. Like a lad will be in the pub looking, not a newspaper, his phone, and be like, well, they need astronauts in NASA. I'll give it a go. It's like that t-shirt. I'm not a gynecologist, but I'll have a look.
You know? Yeah. And we all are.
Well, I think that's what you need. We need some conservative people, and we need some lunatics. Like the absolute edge of lunacy is obviously Elon Musk. You know, and I'm glad that they're around. We need to might need to get the proportions a bit more adjusted. But yeah, you went back, and for the listeners who don't really know, it's a huge thing to step out of being on the hotel GM track. And then go into bars. And then, like with Homeboy, you became one of the, let's say, five or eight most famous bars in the UK. And you did it. Yep. I mean, the first one was what? Shepherd's Bush?
The first one was 108 Essex Road in Islington. Yeah.
In Islington. And you opened a couple of branches. You've gone on to this as well. Tell me, if somebody, ambitious 25-year-old came to you right now and said, should I open a bar? What would you say?
Oof. I would say do it with somebody. Don't do it on your own. When you first open your own business, it's great to have somebody that you can bounce ideas off, bounce questions off, and know it that you're not in it alone. Because I'll always remember paying our first, I don't know whether it was our first big build of the fit out, or it was something along that lines, where it was £20,000, and that was all I had in my savings at the time. And it was hit click, and you're kind of in that mental framework and be like, all the bad stuff comes into your head. Is it going to be worth it? Am I going to make it a success? What happens if I fail? I'm going to be broke, so on and so forth. What I would say is do it. If you do it, just remember your first premise, your first bar is not going to be the bar that you want. You need to sacrifice on design aspects. You need to sacrifice on the finished product, I would say, because you're not going to be, if you don't have an investor, which we didn't, you're not going to be able to do it all at the first time. It is going to be a growth stage. You put what you can in place, you get your service and your drinks are the two most memorable things that people remember. Then it's your decor. So get your hospitality and your service spot on first. Then you have tasty drinks. People will come back. Once you have that in place and money starts to come in the tills, then you can start looking at the decor of the place and making it as you want. So I remember last year, or was it the year? 3 years in Essex Road, we completely gutted the place and revamped it after 3 years of operating and owning it. So just know it takes time. Don't think you can do everything at once, because you simply can't.
That's brilliant advice. And I share it as well. We did that with my place, Door 74 in Amsterdam. Mm-hmm. But the greatest example ever, I think, is a very famous bar from London that I think is still ticking along. I certainly hope it is. 67 Colebrook Row.
Just down the road.
It is open.
Down the road from us. Yeah, it's open, yeah.
Beautiful. Amazing bar set up by Tony Conigliaro. But they had so little money when they opened it. I think his business partner, the lady owned a pub as well, that for the first 8 months of business, their speed rail was a Belgian beer crate that had been sawn in half and duct taped onto the station. That was it.
Yeah, love it.
You know, I have another guy who works with me in Rotterdam, English lad, and he went on to open a great nightclub called Talia Lounge. And he had kind of learned all his bartending with us. We had like the nicest stainless steel stations in all of the Netherlands. But he opened up Talia Lounge, and all his stations were made out of plywood. And he said, well, look, I don't have money for stainless steel now, right? So it'll be a bit of a piece of shit, at least behind the scenes for a while, but we're going to have money down the road.
Exactly. And that's what you need to have confidence in the concept that you're bringing to your guest, and it will work. Because I remember when we first opened on Essex Road, that street was one street over from Upper Street, and Upper Street was where you wanted to be. That was where all the restaurants were. Yeah. That's where the bars were. And people were saying to us, you're idiots to go on Essex Road. Nobody's going to come down there. That's the rough street. That's the dodgy street. But if you create something that people resonate with, people will come. And now Essex Road is gentrified. It has a coffee roasters. It has one of the best bakeries in London. It has a Neil's Yard cheese dairy. So, like, yeah, I'd say we've definitely gentrified that street.
Well, that's how it goes. I went to, I'm very fortunate. In the building where I live, there's an 8-seat bar downstairs. Amazing. And one of the bartenders was just tempted away to be the night manager at this. I mean, brew pub doesn't do it justice. It's on three levels. It opens at 7 in the morning. It's got a bottle shop, a coffee shop, a rooftop, cocktails. They're opening a speakeasy in 2 months. It's bonkers.
Wow.
But it is in the middle of nowhere. I mean, there's nothing. There's no apartment buildings nearby. It's all like, plants hire machinery. If you want to hire a forklift truck, great. Anything else? No. And they are quite clearly betting on the neighborhood, and they'll probably do very, very well. If you build it, they will come.
They will come, yeah, exactly.
But I want to
And as back. Well, yeah, go for it.
No, I just wanted to go back to the thing you said. I want to emphasize it and I want everybody listening to hear. There's a lot of sweat equity deals going around, and, you know, young barmen and ladies saying they're the owner, and they're not. Right. They're promised some theoretical 10% if the bar breaks even. And when there are people who have truly earned their sweat equity, our mutual friends, Sean Muldoon and Jack McGarry, for instance.
Yeah. 100%.
They added so much value to the Dead Rabbit that it is now, you know, absolutely worthy for them. Absolutely worth. But for other people, you become a bar owner when you click that confirm button. And you see 20 or 50 or $100,000 or euros or pounds, every penny you've scrimped and saved for decades, or you've borrowed it from your family, and it all is going to some landlord or contractor or whatever. That's when you either grow a pair or you get out of the game. That's when you become
exactly.
And
that's, that's it.
The second time you become a bar owner is when you sleep in your own bar.
Yeah, 100%. And I've done it. The thing is you know, I like what you said, you either grow a set of balls or you get out of it. When you click that money and the money goes and your account is on zero, you just go to yourself, I'm going to make this work, and nothing else gets in your way. And then all of a sudden, you know, you start to see things in yourself that you've never seen. You become a marketeer. You become all of the above, handymans and tradesmen. But it probably is the best thing I've ever done. It's scary, but it's the best thing you'll ever do.
I mean, some of the advice I would put in, it might seem very banal, is spend a couple of months going to community college or whatever at night, learn to be a decent plumber, learn to be a decent electrician. Timo Jansa, who worked at Door 74 back in the day, he's opened some great bars in Amsterdam, Belly of the Beast, Flying Dutchman, Dutch Courage, together with his business partner, Tess.
Tess
also worked in Door 74. They actually got so sick of paying for plumbers. Also, Flying Dutchman is in a building from the 1600s. They actually did a plumbing course. So now they do all their own plumbing. They can weld.
And wow.
I think Timo's just done an electrician's course. And Tess has got pissed off with paying for designers for bar systems. So she's either done, or has said she will do, a CAD course, computer aided design. Like, these things take much less time than you'd imagine.
Yep. Right?
And it's going to, oh my God, for a little bar, it's going to make you or break you.
And I just on that point as well, if you are, like you said, learning additional skills to aid you in your job, remember, most bartenders, their goal is to open their bar, their own bar. Not many bartenders or head bartenders have been put in management positions before, which have read a P&L, which have dealt with wage percentages. Go do a week as an accountancy course or something. Learn how to read a P&L, learn how to GP a drink, and learn what your break even is. That is the three most important things, because at the end of the day, you're not opening a bar, you're opening a business, and you need to look at it from a business perspective, not from a bar perspective, and that you're going to have creative freedom. It's great having creative freedom, but if you don't know how to read your books, you're not going to have a bar.
Yeah, but if you open a bar, having been a bartender, you cease to be a bartender and you become a manager. You're no longer the striker, the coach, the quarterback, or quarterback. You're the coach. You've got to help. You've got to be Ted Lasso, right? You're not Jamie.
And exactly.
These skills, you can. It's so easy to learn them now. You can go on YouTube for an hour or two. You can read Marketing for Dummies. It's actually really good, right? There are so many people. There are so many people who don't have that idea. And getting down to the cold reality, you don't. Gordon Ramsay doesn't really get to cook in his restaurants, and you are not going to get to bartend in your place. And you might have the fantasy of flitting around from table to table like Humphrey Bogart in Casablanca, but the reality is more that you're going to be mopping a backflowing toilet.
Yeah, you're basically the person there to assist your bartenders. You're going to be the barback. You're going to be the skivvy. You're going to be the kitchen porter. You know, yes, you're going to bartend some nights of the week for the first 6-7 months until the bar is established and you have the cash flow to be able to hire more people. So you can actually do the admin, do the boring stuff, as some people say. But no, you're right. You're just there to assist people in your business.
I mean, it's always very frustrating to me when a place is absolutely gorgeous. I mean, no amount of money spared in the fit out, and they have the audio and they've hired the expensive agency. But the staff, their technical service isn't good and their hospitality isn't good, because the technical service and the hospitality is just about the only stuff that's free. You can teach it every single day, and that's your job as a manager.
Yeah, 100% agree.
Start with one of the best things ever was the 10 pennies thing. You ever hear about this?
Go for it.
You have 10 pennies. You start off your shift as manager, 10 pennies in your left-hand pocket. And every time you give one of your staff a compliment for work well done, you transfer a penny from the left pocket to the right, and you've got to have them all in the right-hand pocket every shift.
That's brilliant. Love that.
It's great, isn't it? Right?
Yeah, simple but effective.
Well, a lot of things, and again, we don't need to repeat the fact that this was before you were born, Kira, but until this cocktail revolution that, you know, Bottle Cocktail Shop is a part of now, and that you have been a part of with the various bars you've worked in, it really only kicked off again in 1995 in London with the opening of the Atlantic Bar and Grill by a Sligo lad, Oliver Payton. Mm-hmm. And then there were people like Dale DeGroff doing great work in New York City, but it was to a much smaller public. The Atlantic was very large and democratic and egalitarian. If you looked like you dressed up a bit, you got in, which is why they refused Robert De Niro once. He apparently tipped up looking like a homeless person and they wouldn't let him in.
But oh, really?
Oh, yeah, that actually happens. Yeah. But
wow,
the States didn't get on board with slowing down to make craft cocktails until, let's say, maybe 2003. Because that meant making less drinks, and that meant making less tips, right? And that was a huge, huge thing. Back before the early 2000s, and I had worked illegally in New York bartending then, the ambition of a New York bartender was to be what they called a mechanic. You made 200 drinks an hour. That's everything from beer and glasses of wine to cocktails. And you got $1 an hour tip. So you might walk with $1,000 or $1,500 or maybe a bit more. So the idea of slowing down to make a better drink was absolute rat poison to them. And for many years, I had American friends, long-term friends. They'd come and visit me in the Netherlands. They'd come and visit me in London. And I'd take them out to the Lab or the Atlantic or Alphabet, if you remember that. And, you know, we'd have the most amazing things. Like, can you imagine having your first fucking Bramble? You know?
Yeah.
And they'd all be like, ah, but Phil, we can't do this in America. Can't do it. One of them said, Philip, what do you think I should do? Get a monkey to sit on my bar and squeeze lemons. 5 years after that remark, the gentleman in question had like a chef's jacket with bar chef on it. So this thing has not been going that long. What I'm going a very long way around saying is, a lot of the baby was thrown out with the bathwater. For instance, I'm an old flair bartender, World Finals 1999, and flair bartending contests evolved speed drink making rounds to their highest level. They've never been better. All the stuff that's come since then has frankly been a bit of a fucking joke, right? Like the rematches of this world. It's just a mess. Really?
Yeah.
And that was thrown away. And being able to read a P&L, I was taught that in TGI Fridays when I was a young man. I was taught how to GP a cocktail. Have you ever heard of Death & Company?
Yeah, absolutely.
Did you know they didn't do a stock take for the first, I don't know, 8 years of their existence?
No.
They didn't know.
Well,
and nobody wanted to. They do now. I'm sure it's great.
Yeah, of course.
Alex and Dave. But like, that's a mind-boggling, jaw-dropping thing. It's like hearing a surgeon doesn't wash his fucking scalpels. Right?
Yeah.
There are so many people. I could take you, honestly, you could meet a lot of the top New York bartenders and North American bartenders, and many of them will not know how to GP a cocktail. The same would be true in London as well.
Yeah. 100%. But going back to what you said on the TGI Fridays, there's still some of the training methods of TGI Fridays and their theories, such as volleyball theory, tacit agreement, swan theory, they still exist in the bars today and are a great touch point, because especially in London, back before TGI Fridays was a restaurant, that's where the standard of training came from. And then from TGI Fridays, that developed into your Be At Ones, your London Cocktail Clubs, and so on. So you can see the trickle-down effect, but some of that is still really present today.
Yeah. And like, here's what I call the paradox of information. Back then, back in the day, again, before you were born, or when you were fucking young, right? There were no trade shows. There were no trade shows. There was no tales, no bar content. The books were all shit. There was no internet, really. We didn't have the websites. So, you know, there was just no way to get the information. Now, you're drowning in information. Fridays used to train their bartenders for 6 weeks. I was a trainer. I would train people for 6 weeks.
Yeah.
One-on-one, or maybe two-on-one. Like, that was a big controversy. Like, ooh, can a trainer train two people at the same time? No, that was real. That's how seriously took it. And on the other hand, also, in 1993, I made 30 to 35,000 pounds a year in London. That would be a stupendous...
That's a great wage. Yeah. That's
a good wage now, 30 years later, which shows you. And you probably can't rent my old two-bedroom flat in Balham for £600 a month anymore. So that's another thing. No, I did.
Yeah.
Right on the comment.
That's crazy.
That's mad. But what it was, all this training contributed to amazing management candidates. And historically, the problem has been that bartenders don't go into management. In the States, it's because they make too much money. And in Europe, I think you can probably see it for a temperament thing. If you're a bartender, you can be quite an asshole in that you operate on your own. You don't need anybody. The guests literally come to you, right? The waiters come to the bar to collect the drinks. Whereas if you're a waiter, you have to be a UN peacekeeper, because you don't cook the food and you don't make the drinks. You don't even seat the guests. You're dependent on the host for that. So inherently, most waitstaff, I feel, and I'm open to a discussion here, I feel are better suited for management. They've just had that experience. What do you think?
That's an interesting one. I definitely feel, I've never thought about it like that in terms of, is a bartender or a waiter more skilled for a manager's position? But if we're going to delve into the point a little bit more, I have always said a waiter's position is harder than a manager's position, especially from what I see in London. Because if you're a seated and standing cocktail bar versus just seated, or even with seated, you're looking after 5-6 tables at one time. You're making sure your touchbacks are happening with every drink. You're making sure your water is topped up. You're also taking orders at the same time while seating somebody. Basically, you're multitasking versus a point bartender. You're just dealing with 4 to 6 people on point, making sure the drinks are coming out correct and you're entertaining them. Where a waiter has to go to and fro, keep their guests entertained, keep on top of them, touchbacks, so on and so forth. So in that regards, yeah, I think a waiter probably is maybe better suited to management in terms of they already have more to juggle on shift versus what a bartender does. Because then if we even take a dispense bartender, for example, they're dealing with two on their station in front of them and 4 tickets at a time. It's pretty standard. It's pretty easy to do, right?
Yeah, I mean, a dispense, you know, the service bar is a great place to start when you're young. And it's a great place to start to develop your speed because it's a speed round every single night, right? Yeah. And you're banging it out. Like the Friday's unofficial graduation was that your trainer would, you do an afternoon shift on a Saturday. And your trainer, this was not official policy, by the way, it's just everybody did it. Your trainer would take you out and get you properly drunk.
Right.
Like South London drunk. Right.
Right.
And you would have to work the service bar the next day. Right. Where you've got four blenders, Hamilton Beaches. The one place I worked at, we changed out 30 clutches a month.
Wow.
And everything is, you know, it's all these smoothies and flings and booze. And sometimes you got, you know, milkshakes for kids coming back and said, yeah, the dad wants you to put some whiskey in this. I mean, it was unrelenting. And if you made it to the end of that shift, then you were a bartender.
Brilliant. Love it. It's like your initiation.
It really was. It's like the Navy SEALs take you out and get you absolutely hammered. You know?
And then you need to go do a job the next day.
Well, did you ever meet Jonathan Downey?
No, I never met him. And believe it or not, I've been in obviously Attaboy loads of times, the original Milk and Honey, but I was only ever in the Milk and only ever got to go to the Milk and Honey once in London on the week of its closure.
Wow. Well, if you have to go, it was lovely. It was gorgeous. Jonathan is a legendary bar owner, obviously founder of Milk and Honey London, but also more importantly, founder of Match Bar Group, which
bar
did
group,
more
yeah.
than anything else. And Match Bar, its reverberations are being felt throughout the UK right now, the same way Friday's reverberations carry down. I mean, the level of training was insane. The level of investment, they paid Mark Ridgewell from Taste and Flavour to come in and do category trainings every single month. And then at the category training the next month, you'd be tested on what you learned the previous month. It was
wild. That's funny. I was actually just reading, I think it was 2 weeks ago, Match Bar's training group from a couple of years ago, and the title on it was said Kevin Armstrong, obviously of Satan's Whiskers, when he used to work at Match Bar Group. I think it was like Match Bar Group training 3.0, and the detail in every single point that they were trying to get across was fascinating, which I actually really took some points away for to add to our training program. But it was to think that was maybe 5, 6, 7, maybe 10 years ago, but to still have relevancy today shows how far ahead of the curve they were.
Yeah, these were places. They expanded to a group at one stage. I think there was as many as 8 of them. They had a place in the Alps. They had a place in Ibiza. And Jonathan was very clever. He had already seen something that myself and Angus Winchester had seen many years before. I like to say me and Angus discovered Australia in the sense that we were teaching about spirits and cocktails and bars on behalf of brands, him for Tanqueray, me for various ones. And we were some of the first people, let's say, from the London scene to go to Australia. We were like, fuck, pound for pound, to this day, the best mixology scene on the planet. No question.
Wow.
You know, and Jonathan set it up so that, you know, Australians could get 2 or 3 year working visas for Europe if they were under a certain age. So you could come and work a season in Ibiza, then you could work winter in the Alps, and then you could come to London. And that'd be your 2 or 3 years. That's exactly what Tim Phillips did. And Tim, of course, went on to be a Diageo world-class champion, opened his own amazing bar, Bulletin Place, in Sydney, and is now, I think, with the Johnny Walker team, and he lives in Amsterdam, and he's very, very happy. But Jonathan was, you know, a hard taskmaster, and he's somebody... he got into bars. He's a Manchester lad because he liked the vibe and he liked the music. And he then became a pretty genius interior designer and someone who knew a lot about cocktails. And he still does.
Yeah, it's a shame. It's a shame to see the venue still sitting idle in Soho when you walk by it. It still has the burgundy doors, but it's just covered up now with just posters. It's a real shame that nobody is taking on. You know, I thought was going to take it on, and if they do take it on, because I'm saying it here first, hopefully they give me some royalties. I thought it would have been a great and amazing fit for the Dead Rabbit, for Jack McGarry to go back to where he started, but also it's a treat four levels.
Yes,
like the Dead Rabbit, you have the parlor, you have the banqueting room, you have the tap room downstairs. I just thought it was going to be a perfect fit.
Yeah. And
I thought it was going to be a match made in heaven. So they haven't yet, but I know they're under expansion of the US now, but after they hear this, they might have a little look.
Jack, if you're listening, call me. I know a guy. But what I wanted to say was, whatever your thing is, when you get into owning bars, you come out a different thing. If you come in as a chef, you'll come out focusing on mixology. If you come in as a DJ, you'll come out as an interior designer. It really doesn't 100%. Matter. And one of the greatest ego detoxes, if you come from the world of spirits and cocktails and bartending, as I do and you do too, is... Mm-hmm. The revelation, oh my God, the drinks are not the most important thing. Which, by extension, means that you are not the most important thing. At least that the person making the drinks is not. You realize that possibly the single most important factor in a bar or a restaurant is actually the lighting.
Heat, light, music, smell. Four most important things for me. And the most important thing out of them four is the lighting. Now, for me, I love a dark bar. Very, very much so. Love a dark, moody bar. One of my favorites, two of my favorites, same guys. Obviously, Attaboy in New York and Temple Bar. The last time I was in New York, I went to Temple Bar. And when you go into Temple Bar, down the end, take a right into the back room where it's just, you can barely see a hand in front of your face. That's my ideal lighting.
No, it's great. I mean, my wife used to go to Temple Bar back in the day. And she's like, yeah, now it's amazing drinks. And much fewer people are doing coke or having sex in the toilets. It's not like zero, but it's much fewer.
Fair.
Now, Temple Bar is brilliant. But yeah, the realization, like if you have the lighting right, the person you're with looks better, you look better, the drink looks better. This doesn't mean you can get away with shit drunks. But most people would rather have an average drink in a well-lit bar or restaurant than an amazing drink in a poorly lit one. And there's plenty of them. The only problem is people can't articulate this. They don't realize it. They just say, oh, I like that bar. But they don't analyze it any more than you or me analyze the financial collateralized debt obligation if you're signing a mortgage. You're just like, I don't know where the money goes. It's so important.
And it's so important and so true. And it's to have the right music at the right time as well. Not blaring, you know...
That was always 90s, Jonathan Downey's thing. Right music. So
important. And at the right level. So important. Like we separate our playlists in the Bottle Cocktail Shop. It goes 12 to 5, 5 to 6, 6 to 7, 7 to 8, and then 9 to 10. So at every different section of the day, the tempo gets a little bit more upbeat. The profanity gets a little bit more. It's a little bit more sexier. You don't want at 12 o'clock in the day, you don't want 90s hip hop Biggie or Tupac just screaming profanities down the speaker. So yeah, massive important thing. Like you're going to accept an average drink in a bar that has great service, great lighting, great music versus a bar that has a fantastic drink, but the service is not there. The music is a bit weird. It's almost like it's like techno at 8 o'clock in the day. And you're kind of like, I don't know how this fits and where it fits. And we've all been in them bars. And even some of them bars are on the 50 best.
Oh my God. So many.
It's a
thing. Like, well, actually, I think this links to your statement earlier, our discussion about management, because here's the thing again, as a bartender, you're behind the bar. That's the basic definition of being a bartender. So the music literally sounds different to you. It's being projected past you onto the guest. So it might be too loud for the guest, but you think it's grand. And by the way, you work 40 hours a week in this environment. Most people work in a nice, quiet office, and they never hear amplified music. That's why the job of a manager is so important. I've always said that a manager is like a defense lawyer for the customers. Right. You can listen to the bartenders, you can listen to the waiters, you can listen to the cooks, but as you are the advocate for the customer out there. You sit in every seat, you work out if there's a fucking horrible draft here, or this speaker is too loud, or you can't quite see that. And like, even to this day, one of the most basic things you can ever do is sit in every seat in your venue. And it's amazing how many people have ever done that who own places or run.
And when you do, what you pick up and what you see is either lacking or what needs to be fixed or what needs to be touched up. But a good, going back to the music, a good rule of thumb is, if the manager can't get to walk to every single space when the place is packed or when the place only has a few people in because they have enough things on their list, play the music a decibel above speaking level. That way people have to sit up, they have to project their voice. And what does that do? It makes people seem more confident. They're speaking with authority and makes them look cooler and sexier. So if you're ever stuck, just play it, play your music one decibel above speaking level and you'll always be at the right level.
That's amazing. I mean, it is such a human thing to be in a room with that buzz. And actually, for me, it was last week or the week before on Friday, I went along, I went out for a drink with a mate of mine to Bemelman's Bar at the Carlisle, where there's, you know, $40 Gibson martinis.
Yeah.
The room had gone through a renaissance in the last decade or so, particularly during COVID, actually, because somebody wrote an article, which was clearly bollocks. It was clearly not true. That, you know, 22-year-old TikTokers were going into Bemelman's Bar and TikToking themselves with these like 70-year-old bartenders. This was absolutely not true. But in the nature of America, it actually became a true thing because other people shared the article and 22-year-old TikTokers began going in and hassling poor Luis, who's been there for 45 years. And the net upshot was on a Friday. Well, first of all, I had to pull strings to get in the fucking door. Like, it used to be you could always stroll in. Now I have to, like, use my connections.
And we got
a beautiful seat. We got a beautiful seat. And the room was just buzzing. And it was the perfect mix of New Yorkers, foreigners, young people, old people, people who were, like, looking around like, holy shit, this is fucking amazing. And other people who were like chilling back, like, I've been coming here since 1974. Like, it was just great. But I noticed, I literally, sometimes if you squint your eyes, everything goes hazy. You can also sometimes squint your ears. So you're not listening to anything. You're just listening to the buzz.
Buzz of the place.
That's the sound of a great bar.
It's infectious.
Fucking bar.
Yeah, it's infectious.
But let's talk about some other things. I wanted to talk about some controversial things. Kira,
okay.
Trans people in sports. Only kidding. that would be the easy option.
Yeah, I feel like that's the topic of the American news at the moment. That's all you see from over here anyway.
Yeah, there's like four trans people in New York, but Jesus, that's all you hear. No, I'm going to talk about something even more controversial, and it is, of course, the N-word, right? Something that you're very involved with the Bottle Cocktail Shop, which is to say non-alcoholic spirits.
Mm-hmm.
Are they bollocks or what?
In terms of what?
Well, there's a couple of ways to look around this. And let's say, obviously, it became a gold rush. Everyone ran into it. There are excellent spirits. I'm doing that annoying thing with my fingers, like Seedlip, and they say, "Hey, look, we're a taste company. We're not trying to be gin. We're not trying to be this. We're not trying to be that." Then there's other companies. Liars springs to mind. They make excellent substitutes. They make a whiskey. They make a gin. They make a rum. Yeah. They make a agave. All that kind of thing. And there's stuff that's all the way in between. In different ways. But two things are, I think, very important for these products. And one is achieving flavor stability without the use of alcohol. And the other thing, of course, is the old price.
Yeah. Me personally, I think it's all bollocks. Why I think it's bollocks is from experience, from actually serving drinks in the bar, and not even 10% of our consumers or guests ask for non-alcoholic cocktails. And so much so that we decided, you know, most menus you read, the non-alcoholics are just hidden at the back of the menu, like a forgotten away drink that nobody really cares about, bartenders don't care about. We decided against that. We put our one non-alcoholic drink on the very first page of our new menu. Be like, you want like non-alcoholics? There you go. I think we've sold three. For me, I think it should be all about flavor and it should all be about taste. I really like what Seedlip is doing. Their flavors, they do carry through. They do stand up when you put it in a highball using soda. Obviously, you have to manipulate the flavor of lot through either non-alcoholic tinctures or using different types of plant bleeds throughout it. But one thing that actually, funny enough, we were having a discussion about the other day, and it's the same with non-alcoholic beers. You're stripping the alcohol out, but you're trying to charge people the same price as an alcoholic beverage. Like, why don't you look at it? I think do they do it in Australia, where it is the higher the ABV on a beer, the higher the cost of that drink, where the lower the ABV, the cheaper it is. Well, why don't we do that with non-alcoholic spirits? And I feel like the majority of them shouldn't be called spirits. Yes, you're trying to mimic a spirit, but you're missing the mark. Especially, a lot of this comes to mind when I think of the gins. Like, a lot of the gins do not taste like gin. So what we try to do is, we do have a few non-alcoholic cocktails available on our menu, on our cocktail menu, but also in the bottle aspect of the bar, of the concept, on the shelf. But what we try to do is, we try to just go for flavor rather than something that's trying to mimic something that clearly is not mimicking what it's supposed to do.
Well, the thing with beer is an interesting one, because I know there's brilliant non-alcs in the UK. And there's a friend of ours, shout out to Andrew, he actually imports the amazing New York-based Athletic Brewing into the UK. And if you come round to our house, we basically, unless I really want to go overboard and it's Christmas, we basically don't have alcoholic beer in the house at all anymore. We just have Athletic Brewing because it's so good.
I can't believe you brought up Atlantic Brewing. I only tried that for the first time 2 weeks ago in TT in London. And TT, it's hands down, the best non-alcoholic beer I've tried to date.
Yeah.
And it's phenomenal.
It actually, a six pack costs $2 or $3 more than you can get an excellent alcoholic beer for Negra Modelo. But I'm like grand with that. It comes down to 80 cents a bottle. No worries. Because you can drink it in exactly the same way. The problem with the non-alc, you know, be it tequila, be it an amorphous thing, is you can't drink it neat, and that's grand. So for them, I think the future is canned cocktails, because my mate Anthony Pullen, who briefly worked for me actually in Amsterdam, is now the VP of marketing for Liars in the USA. Mm. And we do dry January every year, or try to. And he sent us a load of the cans. They have a G&T. They have an American whiskey and Coke. They have a kind of an Aperol Spritz, all this. These non-alcoholic drinks are better in almost every case than the 5% ABV cans you'll see in a train station in the UK. They are so fucking good. And it's the perfect showcase for these non-alc flavors. Yeah. Like, their non-alcoholic Prosecco is mind-boggling. You'll never drink alcoholic Prosecco again. Is that good?
I didn't even know Liars were doing non-alcoholic canned cocktails.
Yeah. I mean, they might have just launched in the US and Australia to kick off with. But these are stunning. And the other thing that was brought up, you know, I do think they have a reason to exist. I was having a drink with Dan, the commercial director for Everleaf at the Chelsea Hotel in New York City.
Yep.
Not so long ago. Dan's a lovely guy. And we had some Everleaf cocktails, and they were fantastic. And I could see a world where, you know, I wouldn't drink them all night. I wouldn't drink cocktails all night. But if I was out, I might switch one in between my second and third drink, or my third and fourth drink. And these were made with a great deal of care and attention by the bartenders. And were they expensive? Grand. But if you're going out to a bar, while cost is important, it's something you shouldn't analyze too much, because you can always drink cheaper at home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I think you're right in terms of what I've noticed over here is, if people are going out on a day session or going out, they know they're going to be drinking for 12 hours, 8 hours, whether they're going to like an early football game that just kicks on straight into the rest of the evening, they use non-alcoholic beer as every second or third, I'm going to have a non-alc. So I'm not just plastering myself with booze where I'm going to be incoherent by 10 or 11 o'clock. So I definitely do think it does have a place. I'm a person that I wouldn't be a massive drinker. like in terms of maybe once a week or not even that. So I definitely find myself, if I'm going out with my mates for a beer to catch up, I find myself drinking a non-alcoholic beer. I can't stand the non-alcoholic spirits, but there's definitely a place for the non-alcoholic beers.
Well, they're just so far ahead of the game. That's really what
I think so. But I think as well, the market in terms of for the non-alcs is quite oversaturated. So you really do need to have something to stand yourself above the rest and above the pack.
Yeah, I mean, there's great ones like Everleaf, Seedlip, Liars.
Liars is really good.
But I think it's been a bit of a bubble. And again, this is probably something that, you know, even if you're a young bartender, definitely if you're a manager or an owner, you should realize there'll be a million people shouting that this is the next thing, right? But it's not. They're just trying to make it happen. Like there's a lot.
Yeah, so rum was supposed to be the next gin for the last 7 years.
It's always, this is rum's year. And it has been that way for a decade or two. But with the non-alcs, the drinks companies, they can't lose because any money they invest in a non-alc brand, they can just take it out of their social responsibility budget. You know?
Exactly.
So they've got two ways to win and no way to lose. And there's all these research reports like, oh, it's going to be worth $11 billion. Because they're like, well, what if we got 1% of the water market? And what if we got 1% of the soft drinks market and all of that? And they're just either, you know, not realizing or willfully ignoring the fact. Like when I actually talk to bar managers, bar owners, people like yourself, be it here, Vancouver, fucking Singapore or Italy, they're like, yeah, they don't actually sell.
Yeah, exactly. They don't.
That's the reality. Everybody is pushing this, but it doesn't actually mean that it's true.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Yeah. Sometimes brands have too much budget to know what to do or what sense.
Well, it's a thing that you learn about if you do a business degree, but definitely if you do an MBA. And it's basically your job. If you certainly go to the trouble of getting an MBA, you want to be the boss at some stage, right? And that now means, I think, a lot in business that you can't fuck up. And that means don't worry about creating a new product. Don't worry about innovating. Don't worry about starting a new division. Just focus on not fucking up and outlast everybody else.
Mm.
And that means when there's, let's say you're putting an innovation project, you're like, well, first of all, we need to benchmark, right? Like, what did other people do? And then you'll hire an agency and you'll say, so what's the research look like, right? And you'll wind up making something fucking stupid, like Bailey's Red Cupcake, right? Or Red Velvet Cupcake.
Yeah. Right?
But your arse is fully covered. Even if it doesn't work out, you'd be like, well, the agency said this, and we benchmarked it. It looks like I'm doing a TikTok video now.
Yeah.
And you know, and we paid £30,000 for a research report, so.
We have all the statistics there, so it must mean that the market wants it.
Yeah, well, here's a statistic for you. There's 148 liquor companies in the entire world that sell a million cases a year or more, meaning at least 12 million bottles. And of all those brands, only three in the last 55 years were created by a big company. Every other brand was acquired. And those three, in reverse order, are Bailey's.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Malibu.
Okay.
Both created by the same guy, actually. And Woodford Reserve.
Woodford Reserve as well. Wow.
Yeah, that's it, though. That's three out of 148. That's like just over 2%. Every other brand was acquired.
So creativity goes to die in corporations because there's too much red tape.
Well, I don't think that's the problem. The problem is that if you decide, hey, we can just buy brands, that's absolutely fine and legit. But then you have to grow them. Like, even when you were coming up, and definitely in the UK, you would have seen Finlandia Vodka, right? And Finlandia was once a major player, but it has declined to almost nothing at all. You know, if you make, and like, see also 42 Below Vodka.
Yeah.
That was doing 180,000 cases globally at the time of its acquisition. And now they probably bottle less than IP every year. Like, they have been just mismanaged into the ground. So
yeah, Bacardi tried to make a resurgence of it there about, what was it, maybe a year or two ago. They were paying for big listings over here for rail and cocktail listings, and it's still, nobody really talks about it or hear it. It's predominantly the market over here would be Kettle One or Belvedere, really, as your rail.
Yeah, mad. Let's talk about that for a minute. I think this will lead into a conversation about the bottle cocktail company. Many of our listeners are American, and they think that the rest of the world is some Al Capone corrupt bollocks where you're just being showered as a bar owner with money by brands. Whereas in the USA, in order to get listings, you have to literally go in and have a conversation with the microphones and phones off and say, hey, if you list the brand, we'll book a $10,000 party with you. And the, you know, Dave, the ambassador, will come in and run his card, or, you know, bring his mates in and spend $300. Whereas in the UK and the rest of the EU, it's a straightforward business contract. You sit down and you say, here's the budget, here's the returnables, this is what success looks for us. We might give you a retroactive discount on the bottles, or maybe we want to help you get into the world's 50 best or the tails and nominations. But everybody has goals, responsibilities, budgets. Which system do you think is better?
Good question. I think the UK system is better simply because when you have the opportunity to open a bar as a first-time business owner, them listing fees help you with cash flow to get your business off the ground, to ensure that, you know, that first quarter's rent or that first few weeks of wages, you know you can pay them and you know you can secure it. So the brands do help a lot of new bars get off the ground. And I think that's probably why you see in the UK and Europe a lot more bars opening a year versus the US, because I presume in places like New York, you need to have a big investor behind you to get a venue to be able to fit the venue out. Where, yeah, things in London now are a bit out of control when you're talking about rent pricing and fit out costs. However, there is still opportunity within little unknown boroughs to get that great little venue that has maybe 20, 25 covers that you and your two mates that are bartenders can put your life savings into open. And when you have a proven track record of working in some of the best bars, and then you approach these brands about opening your first bar, they're going to have faith in what you can deliver because you've delivered it for other businesses in the past. So I do definitely feel like the UK model is a little bit better place to help new and existing bar owners versus the US market.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that bad. But I mean, the last great bar to open where it really was just the guys with all their tips was Employees Only. And like, it was so bad with the lads. I know them all very well, that they actually opened without running water, right? Wow. They were so broke that they had to open to make a bit of money to buy food. So the first night, they had bar backs running backwards and forwards with bus tubs of water behind the bar at EO.
And what an institution it is now.
It really is. It's amazing. Well, the cash flow thing is true, right? And the problem is that nobody lends money to bars for, you know, without collateral for a very good reason. But that's also a form of discipline, isn't it? Because we've all seen bars open that have too much money behind them.
Yeah, and don't do anything. It goes back to the point you made earlier. It's like, when you see, and actually that's a great point, is what you made earlier where you said you see a bar that has gone to no expense on the fit out, their stainless steel bar stations. Yeah, they don't have their hospitality down to the ground. I feel like a lot of bars, and the next time you're in London, you'll probably go to a few that have just opened, have had hundreds of thousands of pounds of investment, and they've spent it. And they've spent it going, well, you know, we know we still have cash in the bank to keep us afloat. So, you know, when somebody else pays for it, they don't put everything they can into it. And they think the name that they have, I did it air brackets, and the decor alone is going to make the bar survive without actually putting any. I feel like when you put your own money into it and you have the aid of listing fees from brands, you're going to put your heart and your soul into making that a success versus having a bit of sweat equity and taking hundreds of thousands of pounds from somebody. And then, you know, if it fails, well, you just, your sweat equity is lost, but your investor has lost hundreds of thousands of pounds.
Yeah. And, you know, talking about hospitality, you know, the relative age and youth has come up from time to time. As I said, my friend Angus Winchester, he's like, nobody should be a brand ambassador who's not at least 30 years old. Mm. I think there's something in that, right? Mm. Things have changed. But with you sinking your life savings into a bar or a restaurant,
yeah,
you wind up depending on the 19-year-old hostess or the 20-year-old bartender or the 22-year-old cook or the 23-year-old waiter. And do you think hospitality, being hospitable to people, gets easier as you get older and you gain more life experience? How can you jumpstart the situation of being a stupid young person? Because being young is its own kind of stupid. It's also its own kind of attractiveness because you're so full of energy and, you know, in the right direction. But it goes both ways, no?
Yeah, I agree and disagree. I think, you know, well, first and foremost, when you're talking about it comes down to the 22-year-old, the 20-year-old that you hire, I think it's more so that point starts at your hiring process and your interview process. If you hire good people will look after the guests with no training. And I do think you can train some sort of hospitality versus, you know, a lot of people say hospitality, you can't teach it. You either have it or you don't, like how you make a guest feel. I think there is certain things that for a new person to the hospitality industry that hasn't afforded, you know, you can read social cues when you've been in it so long. And I do think the longer you are in hospitality, the more experience you get, the better you are get it. But you can teach a person scenarios, and that's what I like to do with new staff that are green in the industry. Give them to scenarios based of walking them through creating a customer's journey and walking them through the customer journey and go, these are the four points that we do not differ from. I want you to make sure when somebody, the minute you hear that door crack, that person is getting a genuine hello when the guest walks in, because that's the most important interaction. If we don't have a host, the most important interaction is the first person that touches our guest, they get a genuine hello. You seat them to the table, you hand them the menu, glass of water, all of that sort of stuff. But what you don't want to do, what I found in five-star hotels, is you don't want to be scripted. You go, this is the 5 points we want to get across, but I want your personality to come out. So you let them say it in whatever way that they want to say it. And you'll find out when you come to BCS, the Bottle Cocktail Shop, when you come and sit and have a drink in our bar, we all have a different way of explaining about what we are about. But as long as we get our core message across to that new customer, that returning customer, then we're on the same page, because every time that they go back, they're getting a different experience because we're letting each other's different personalities shine through. So yeah, I do agree that hospitality gets better with age, but also there is teachable scenarios, and then you just let that person grow. And I think it all comes back down to that hiring stage. If you hire a good person, naturally when you're sitting across from the interview, if they're warm, if they make you laugh, you know they're going to do that with the guests with no experience. And then when you have them, it's up to you to teach them more and then let them find stuff out. Let them make mistakes. That's the most important thing as well. Let them make mistakes. And not coming down on the person when they do make a mistake, teaching them why you think that's a mistake and having an open discussion about it. Not very much to when I was getting brought up in hospitality, where it was like, you fucked up. This is why you fucked up. Now go fix it. Instead of actually explaining to somebody why throughout the process, how they screwed up.
Yeah. And you've got to bear in mind whether you're young or maybe you've come from a different culture. I trained 2 fleets of cruise ship bartenders once upon a time, and they were all principally from rural Thailand and rural Philippines. And pound for pound, the most enthusiastic, engaged bartenders I've ever done any work with in my entire life. But it was very difficult for them to connect and have small talk with the guests, because the guests would be, you know, middle-aged Americans who own a 5-bedroom house and 3 trucks in Texas. And, you know, these bartenders maybe grown up in a house that wasn't even made of bricks. So that was the thing. And if you're young and you've never been to a fancy bar, you've never been really well looked after, you can work in it. And that's actually how it usually goes. in hotels. I worked in what is now the Mandarin Oriental in Knightsbridge. It was the Hyde Park Hotel there. Yeah, it was a Rocco Forte hotel back there. But everybody came from a little village in Italy. And I suppose I came from a little village in Ireland. but you're literally looking after people who are paying £1,000 a night for a room.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah, I think, yeah. Yeah, and as well, like, I don't want to sound like a broken record, but it does all come back down to your training and your standards and how you get that across to a person from a different background and how you can make it resonate. I think that's probably one of the most important things is finding something that resonates with them and then how they can take ownership. I think ownership is a big thing as well. How can give them something that they can take ownership, that they innately knows that they're looking after what you want them to get across, but in their own genuine way.
Yeah, so tell me, if somebody's sitting across from you and you're thinking about hiring them with some kind of an interview, what's a big red flag? What's a big green flag?
What's a big red flag? For me, a big red flag is jumps on their CV. That's a big red flag for me. It doesn't matter how nice they are, but if they've been in somewhere 6 months, then 6 months, then 3 months, or maybe the other way around, that for me is a big, big red flag. Like, for me personally, I think somebody should be within a position for a minimum of a year to at least really understand that role. But if somebody is leaving a position for less than 12 months, especially around the 6 month mark, I figure something has gone wrong or they do not know. And, you know, they can say to you, hey, look, I've left this bar to go to this bar because it wasn't the right fit for me or so and so, so forth. But I don't know. I always feel like someone's lying to me there. So that's a big red flag for me. Any jumps in CVs, regardless of how nice you are as a person, I'm unfortunately not giving you a chance. A big green flag for me is, first and foremost, is their personality. Their personality. You can have the most experience in the world, but at the end of the day, we work in something called hospitality. So you're supposed to be hospitable. And if you have a warm attitude and a positive attitude with minimum experience, I'm hiring you over somebody that is mundane or boring in the interview, but has worked at some of the best bars in the world and, you know, can tell me more about a Rotovap than I know. Fantastic. But can you make a guest smile? Because at the end of the day, that's what we're here to do. We're here to make the guest smile. And if you can't make a guest smile or you can't have a warm rapport with me in the interview, then it's probably not a good fit.
Yeah. I think it's about giving the guests what they need because guests need different things at different times. And it feels like I've been telling this story on every episode of my podcast lately, but Salvatore Calabresi loves telling this story. When he was a young lad just starting out, he worked in a place with a textbook caricature grumpy chef, right? Mm-hmm. And when you're a young barman and everybody's, you know, they love you and they love your drinks, you can actually get quite cocky, like, oh, I'm a genius at service. So one morning, he decided to go and do a nice thing for the chef. The chef liked espresso, so made a nice espresso and he put a biscuit on the saucer and he brought it in the morning to the chef in the kitchen. He's like, hey, chef. And the chef got it and fucking threw it against the wall. and fucking chased Salvatore out of the kitchen. And Salvatore's manager said to him, yeah, you fucked up. You should have read his mood. Right? He didn't need some chirpy little arsehole coming in here. Right? Some of your guests want to be left alone. Some of your guests are going through a breakup or they just want to drink heavily and quietly on their own. I've been that person from time to time.
Yeah.
So that's the real key.
I mean, it's all about, actually funny, like what you said there, it's all about reading your guests, but we used to always get told something back in hotels, especially when checking a guest in. If a guest is a business guest or a transient guest, a business guest always wants to be checked in fast, given their room key and sent up. They don't want to be told, hey, breakfast is at so-and-so and so on time, dinner's at so-and-so and so on time. That's what the transient guest wants. And that can be transferred, and we do transfer it into bars very much. You need to read the customer that's sitting in front of you. 100%. If you try and engage in conversation, which I definitely encourage our staff to do, if you're getting one word answers and they're quite cold, they want to be left alone, you leave that person alone. And when they want attention, they'll come to you. If a person is openly talking to you, they want you to openly talk to them. And 9 times out of 10, they're probably going to ask you how you made this drink.
Yeah, once there was 2 luxury hotels in Amsterdam, and they got a new intake of staff, all the departments. And they were all young, as many, many hotel staff mm-hmm. are. So they did a kind of a very clever thing. They helped train each other's staff up. The staff slept at like the other hotel. Then you got, you know, they had the experience of checking in, sleeping over. Then they got up, they had breakfast. Then they went to, fake book an event there. And then they actually had a cocktail training with me at Bartender Academy in Amsterdam. And I was talking to the guy who ran the whole program. He's like, yeah, you know, these are working class kids. I was a working class kid when I worked in a 5-star hotel. They've never slept in a place like this. And if you don't know, if you can't put yourself in the guest's footsteps, right, you just treat them all. I was like, well, these are rich arseholes. Fuck them. But I've had the experience of being flown 18 hours around the world, utterly exhausted, and getting to the hotel and having to line up to check into a $1,000 a night hotel. And all you want is the key. That's it. You're barely holding it together, really.
Yeah.
You know, and someone's like, so the sauna's open at 5:30 a.m. Yeah, yeah.
And you're like, just give me my fucking key. I want to go to sleep.
Oh, man, I need to. Well, you were to kind of go back to Jonathan Downey. The story I wanted to tell about him was that I had lunch with him in Shoreditch one of the last times I was in London a year or two ago. And he told me when he was hiring somebody for like a fairly senior position, a GM position or a group position, he'd hired the guy or he'd interview the guy. They'd have dinner, maybe hang out another time. But then they'd go out drinking. And they'd go out drinking in one of Jonathan's bars on a Saturday night. And Jonathan would ask for a sea breeze with a lime in it, which was code. It meant the bartender wouldn't put any vodka in it at all. And the other guy would drink whatever he drank. And Jonathan was like, obviously, I wanted him to get drunk. I just needed to know what kind of a drunk he was. Because if you're a bad drunk, you can't be running one of my places or 2-3 places. If you're just a normal person when you're drunk, then, you know, welcome in and the job is yours.
Yeah, it's kind of, there's another one as well I've heard before, which is actually quite good. If you're going to hire someone, bring them for a coffee. Get them to get them to order first. And if they don't know what they want by the time they get to the queue, and if they get to the queue and are looking up at the board and are holding people 5 or 10 minutes, then they can't organize and prioritize what needs to be prioritized. And therefore, you know, you're not the person for me.
Yeah. No, I've got a friend. He's run billion-dollar liquor companies. And he told me about one American boss who did exactly that, but it was lunch. He'd go out to lunch and he would judge you by how quickly you ordered. Right. If you're one of those people like, I don't know, what are you having? Like, oh, done, check. Like,
and the 100%.
The thing you've said about everybody doing everything in their own personality is really important. There's a famous music producer called Rick Rubin. He's just written a book about creativity. And in the book and on many of the podcast interviews he's done, he says, yeah, you've got to leave room to let God in, meaning not God, him or herself. But when you ask something of a creative, being an ad agency or a distiller or a bottle cocktail producer, you have to say, here's the brief. Here's what I want. Here's kind of the result that I want. And the rest is up to you. You have to give them wiggle room, because otherwise you might as well learn distilling yourself.
Yeah, exactly. That's why you've asked for their expertise.
Yeah. And when you hire somebody, in a way, you're doing that too. You're like, hey, this is how we make drinks and speed and service standards, but the rest is up to you.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
And that's the golden space where some people can create something truly amazing.
Yeah, and there's always something I always say is in an interview process as well, is what skills and hobbies do you have that you can bring to this role and that you would like to see us utilizing as well? So, for example, if somebody is incredible at photography, videography. You know, what we like to do is encourage that within the company, but then also pay them some sort of fee that we would usually pay to a professional photographer, but having it in-house, obviously at a reduced rate, but also showing somebody that their skills and hobbies can also be used within their role.
I mean, I think it's even more important to have a skill or a hobby. It's like, I think it's a big red flag in an interview. You ask somebody, what do you do? It's like, oh, what's your hobby? Oh, fitness, cycling. I like reading. Like, I read so much, it is a legit hobby. But, you know, a friend of mine, the GM of a place I worked once, he interviewed a young lady. He said, what, do you have any hobbies? She's like, yeah, I like doing my nails. Like, she was probably very good at doing her nails. But, I mean, if you allow that, it's like, what's your hobby? Sleeping. I'm really good at sleeping. I can sleep like a motherfucker.
I'm sure a lot of people in our industry, their hobby's drinking anyway.
Well, it's more of a heritage, if anything.
A vocation.
Well, hang on a second. So let's get on to business here.
Yep.
Which is the bottle cocktail shop. So you started that about a year and a half ago after stepping out of Homeboy, which had won every conceivable accolade.
Yep.
Obviously, bottle cocktails, long history, more than 120 years, started by the Hubline brothers in Connecticut, upstate New York. A brand, by the way, that Diageo have actually brought back in the USA, although it's not as premium. It's not as premium as it used to be. Everybody got into this during the pandemic, of course, and people started off having things in wonky plastic containers with hand-scribbled labels, and then they worked their way up to the most beautiful, gorgeous things imaginable. But you've gone all in.
Yeah.
So what was the decision-making process like for that?
The decision-making process. So I suppose how the concept for the bottle cocktail shop came up, like you said, I founded Homeboy. So during the pandemic, we had to close our doors. And obviously, like most bars, during the pandemic, we had to pivot. So I was toying with the idea of RTDs. Now, we actually never launched them just simply because during the time we had an insurance claim in during the pandemic. So we didn't kind of want to kind of screw that up if we were seen to be bringing in revenue. So I said to myself, well, let me look at the business model of bottle shops over here, off licenses. And to be honest, they all do the same thing and they're quite boring. And I said to myself, well, if I was to recreate a bottle shop in my image, what would it look like and what would it need? And I said, well, the first and foremost, the thing it would need is a unique selling point. So our unique selling point is our own range of RTDs. So we have 11 RTDs in the range. Why we've chosen bottles is because glass is a neutral carrier of flavor versus cans. Because even when you pasteurize lime or lemon juice and use it within aluminium, it can oxidize over time, which will change the flavor of your RTD. So that's why we've specifically chosen against using cans and using bottles. And also, bottles are multiple serves. And then within the concept itself, obviously previously owning a world-renowned bar, I still wanted to have the aspect of a cocktail bar. So we actually have a cocktail bar in store. So we have our RTDs sold by the bottle, a very curated selection of beers, wines, and spirits, but then we have a cocktail bar where the cocktail bar is what we show off, and it's what we show to the consumer that we can do. Because when RTDs or your bottle cocktails versus your cocktail menu and your cocktail bar are going to be completely different. Your RTDs need to be generic, basic bitch cocktails that people know and people love and enjoy. Why? Is because you're selling it to the masses. You're selling it to everybody. Versus if people want to come have an experience and see how wanky, for lack of a better word, we can get about drinks development, that's why we have our cocktail menu in place. I went all in on it because I can see this business model growing in more versus a bar in terms of, I was looking at this purely from a business perspective. It can grow in various different ways. Obviously, we can grow a bar group with under the umbrella of the bottle cocktail shop, but we can also grow an RTD market leader within the UK. And things only getting worse over here has just strengthened our position and got more market validation. And what I mean by that is Brexit had a massive impact on the hospitality industry over here in the UK, a huge impact. I was reading a statistic the other day that 61% of all hospitality venues in the UK have closed days or reduced hours during the week because of the impact that it's having. So what we want to do, or where our strategy is we want to be the market leader for bars and restaurants that want to have a cocktail program, but want to have speed of service, consistency of product and labor cost savings. And that's where we plug and fit right in. So we started off actually just doing bottled cocktails. So there's 5 100-ml serves per bottle, but we've grown so much now, we've actually are kegging our cocktails as well now for bars and restaurants within London.
That's amazing. And of the range, which I have in front of me, the Session Negroni, the Margarita Aura, the East 8 Hold Up, which is a kind of an in-joke for London bartenders. It's a lovely story. The Diamond Daiquiri, the Cosmo. So yeah, each serve is going to be like £6.40 essentially. So that's like, I don't know, $8, which is, you know, very reasonable.
It's going to be a fiver. So each of our bottles retail for £25, and there's five cocktails in each bottle. So it works out a fiver to the guest.
Oh no, I'm looking at the delivery. Then there's probably put on a few.
Yeah.
So what's the best seller?
What are the best sellers? The best sellers are the Negroni has never stopped. The Negroni's the first. So obviously, first year trading last year, we sold 3,000 bottle cocktails in our first year trading. I would say 30% or 40% of that was the Negroni. But we only introduced the spicy margarita, or should I call it the Cascabel margarita? We only introduced that last September. And that is slowly outgrowing the Negroni. So right now I'd say it would go the Cascabel spicy margarita, it would grow the Negroni, and then it would go to East Day Hole Up.
And then
our old fashioned would peak during the colder months because people like more stirred denim brown. Our two martinis, our martinis sell, but not as much as you think they would sell. And then our top selling drink among actually our female clientele is the Woohoo. So the Woohoo is a twist on your classic 2000 drink, the Woohoo. But what we've done is we've actually taken out the vodka and replaced it with a peated Irish whiskey because peach and smoke work really, really well together. And then the cranberry coming through. So spicy margarita and Negroni, which I think you're drinking in front of you, they're probably our two top best sellers. And then the East Day Hole Up slow after that.
I mean, do you want to tell the story of the East Day Hold Up?
So the East Day Hold Up was invented by Kevin Armstrong, the owner of the world-renowned Satan's Whiskers. So when he used to work for Milk and Honey, he actually got held up at gunpoint in East London. Hence, the name is East 8 Hold Up. So a little homage to that drink. I like to say it's a sophisticated porn star martini because Milk and Honey were too cool to be seen to be doing porn star martinis, but wanted to get on that passion fruit tropical trend. It's a London staple. We do our little way there. Being an RTD, it's probably a little bit sweeter than what you would get in Satan's Whiskers. But yeah, it's a lovely homage to a modern London classic, I suppose.
I mean, it's impossible for my non-English or European listeners to overstate how important the porn star martini is. The best way I can explain it is there's a button on the till in the American bar of the Savoy for a porn star martini, except they just couldn't bring themselves to have Savoy London receipts that said porn star on them. So it's called the Star Martini.
Is it? That's brilliant.
Oh, yeah. No, they have to, because they get so many. Like, what's happened is the passion fruit is not in the American supply chain at all, right?
Oh, wow.
So that has kind of hamstrung the porn star martini from ever getting off the ground here. Americans don't know it. They don't see passion fruits in the supermarkets. It's not a thing. But
actually, funny. I was doing an offsite event with one of the guys, Shiv, that used to work in a lab back in the day. And we were actually doing the traditional recipe of the porn star martini with one heaped teaspoon of vanilla sugar.
Vanilla, yes, of course.
Yeah, that was the first time I've actually ever had the original recipe. Yeah, it's a phenomenal drink.
Yeah, well, I've had the fortune of Douglas making it for me in both Cape Town and London. So they opened a lab in Cape Town, and it didn't last very long. But in the brief 6 or 8 months it was open, I was actually down there, and I got to see what, because it was originally named the Maverick Martini after a strip club that they visited in Cape Town, which, by the way, is still open.
Well, it goes to show what the South Africans like.
Well, they've got priorities down there. But I mean, what's really absolutely come out of nowhere is the espresso martini in the USA. And about a year and a half ago, I got a new market, a new distributor for Old Duff Geneva, which was Minnesota. And I'm like, all right, cool. Mm. And I went to see my brilliant distributor there, Libation Project. Shout out to Libation Project. And I did a little briefing for all the staff, and their headquarters is actually an old fire station, which has a garden. So all the reps are like sitting around in the garden, and I'm doing a little presentation, and Old Duff used to share a distributor in Hong Kong with Mr. Black. A lady who was an ambassador for Mr. Black made an espresso martini with Mr. Black, Bianco Vermouth, and Old Duff Geneva. No espresso, tastes fucking delicious, everything.
Okay.
I made it and I gave everyone a sample. And one of the sales reps who used to be a bartender, she's like, fucking brilliant. Everyone hates the espresso martini. And I was like, what? I never heard this before in my life. She's like, yeah, nobody wants to pull the shot. What she means is it's a pain in the tits to make if you don't have the mise en place.
Mm,
right? Yeah. And that's it. But holy fuck, has it taken off here? Like, this is the true legacy of Dick Bradsell. More Dick than Bradsell, any of the other amazing cocktails he created, this has taken off like a motherfucking rocket. I always remember at the end of 2020, I never really had a local bar in New York City, right? But now I did, because at some times you couldn't even ride the subway. So the local bars became my local bars. Mm. And I would never have been in this one place at 5 p.m. on a Friday, but I stayed a bit longer in the afternoon, getting mildly drunk. Around 5 o'clock, I saw two espresso martinis going out. This is not a cocktail bar, by any means.
Right.
It's a neighborhood bar on like 91st and 2nd Avenue on the Upper East Side.
Yeah.
And then I see three more going out. And then I look around and I see a few at a table. And this bar, a load of teachers come in there. There's a load of schools nearby. And I said to the bartender, I'm like, is this something all the teachers are drinking? He's like, you have no idea. And I'm like, when an unfashionable bar is making vast amounts of this drink, you know
you've made it. Yeah, you know the cocktail's made it. It's actually funny you bring up the espresso martini. It's actually, April is the, over in London now anyway, is the Espresso Martini Festival.
It is.
It is,
according to the PR company that Mr. Black
advised. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, actually, Dick's daughter, Bea Bradsell, is actually doing a masterclass today in Soho on her dad's drink, on the espresso martini.
Oh, she would know. No, they did do Espresso Martini Week for the first time in New York last year. So I think it'll, you know, gain more and more traction and all this sort of thing. So one thing that I wanted to ask you about was the sort of stickiness of drinks trends. So you have, you see what people actually buy to serve at home, right? Mm-hmm. Not the things that they talk about, not the things that the PR companies push, but these are the things that people want to enjoy when they're at home. What have you learned about your customers that surprises you since you started the bottle cocktail shop?
Yeah, I suppose the one thing that really surprised me is the customer has never been more educated than they have before. And I think the pandemic probably has something got to do with that, with people at home making cocktails and cocktails being more becoming more accessible for people making home. So what you find now is when people come into the bar, they're name dropping certain tequilas or certain spirits that they want to have. And if you don't have it, you can obviously will offer an alternative, but they're very specific on what they have. So that was quite an eye opener that, you know, they've done the research. They know what type of flavor profile they want. They know the exact tequila that they want. But in terms of like the RTDs, what we've noticed in terms of cocktails, especially off the our range of bottle cocktails, it's building up trust with the consumer first. So what I mean by that is they go to a classic first. They try what they have already seen in your generic bars all around the world. So that's why the Negroni is the number one seller. Then if they enjoy the Negroni, they'll come back and try something a little bit different, whether that will be the East Day Holdup, which they've never heard before, or whether that be the Woohoo. So you need to, it's almost like the classics are the testing ground. And if you do the classics well, then they'll come back and try an alternative surf. That's the one thing that we found quite eye-opening. And then when it comes to the bar, I think once you have the consumer at your, once they've taken that trust to sit at the bar or sit at the table, they're in your domain, so you can direct them in which way you would like to direct them. But it's very hard to direct. So that's the great thing about the hybrid model of it being a bottle shop and a cocktail bar. You're learning so much more because it's something I've never done before. So I'm learning is you can't, when it comes to the bottle side of things and the bottle shop, you can only direct them to a, with spirits, you can direct them to a point, but when it comes to RTDs, you cannot direct them. They're like, they won't take a gamble on having something else. And what we then try to do is to break that barrier. We'll obviously, that's the great thing about us having a physical venue where we sell our own product. We can give tasters and be like, well, let me taste it. Because they'll go, oh, I like the sound of that, but I'm not confident enough to buy it if I don't like it.
Well, that's why the Apple Store exists, I feel.
Yeah.
You know, like you want a physical environment. You want to see it. You want to touch it. You want to have an emotional reaction to it. And I agree. Customers have never been smarter. Like everybody is now Simon Difford. Like famously, Simon would always walk into a bar and he'd order a daiquiri because that's a classic that every bar can make. But it requires a degree of skill and precision. Like you can make a fucking old fashioned half drunk with fairly crappy whiskey and it's still good. But a daiquiri is kind of make or break.
Yeah, 100%. Like that's for us when it comes to, it's funny you mentioned the daiquiri. We have the Diamond Daiquiri, but we do not call it a classic daiquiri because, you know, a lot of world's 50 best buyers now do this. We don't use any perishable ingredients in our RTDs. Even when it comes to pasteurizing, we just don't do it because we want to ensure, it's more from a health and safety thing. We want to ensure shelf life stability, but we also want to ensure that nothing can have a harmful effect on the customer drinking it. So we've actually made an acid blend we call our super citrus that mimics the flavor of lime, and we use that instead of using lime juice. It took me about a year and a half, nearly 2 years to develop it. I've tasted it again. Super sour is definitely, ours is definitely better. We actually, believe it or not, sell it to a lot of big brands in by like 1,000-liter formats that are actually doing their own keg cocktails now, selling it into the Caribbean and the south of Spain. But when it comes to the daiquiri, you're just never going to get it exactly like lime juice. So when it comes to a classic, like a classic daiquiri, we just can't call our RTD a classic daiquiri. That's why we call it a Diamond Daiquiri.
Yeah. And like your bottles are all in the same format. They're all clearly the same family. Mm. I wanted to ask you about some of our friends. And you know everybody involved, so I've no doubt, at White Box Cocktails.
Yep.
Right, from Alex and Pietro and all those lads. They're all spectacular. In fact, Pietro gave me a little sampler of all of them, one of the last times I was back. But every single one is in a different package.
Mm.
Right? And I think that's, it's like every one is its own brand. There's the Freezer Martini, there's the Old Fashioned, there's the Negroni. And for a customer, I think that might be difficult in that you've got to build 8 different customers.
Yeah, I think what the boys at White Box are doing is, I would say they're probably one of, if not the market leader at the moment over here in the UK. I actually love their branding. And from a branding perspective, I think like the Pocket Negroni and the Freezer Martini, I can almost, even though they're both different, I can kind of see how they relate. Maybe that's me just knowing that it's from the White Box brand, White Box portfolio. And then if you maybe were a customer to first purchase, you might not get that. But I think what they're doing is quite different, quite unique. But then as well, it's all about like why mine, I want mine to look as like a family is because what we're trying to do is we're trying to build up trust with our consumer. I know I probably sound like a broken record with trust, but if they've tried one of our bottle cocktails before and they know specifically know it's from the bottle cocktail shop because it says that's really loud on the label. If they see the bottle cocktail shop on another label, but just a different SKU, then they'll go to themselves, well, I've already had one of their other ones before and I know it's a quality product. So that's why I'm going to choose this one. But then also it comes down to our strategy and where we want to be placed. Like I said, we want to be the number one for bars and restaurants to use, not more so retail, which I think White Box's strategy is more retail because theirs is 100 mil serves where ours is multiple serves. Ours is 500 mil.
Yeah, exactly. And there's other companies like in the US, there's Tip Top and Dash Fire, and they're doing 100 ml cans and they're on Delta Airlines and it's great. And also the format is part of it. It's a cute little thing. Like the old Hudson whiskey bottle used to be small. The old Monkey 47 liquor bottle used to be small. So people would naturally point at it. So it makes a lot of sense. Have you noticed anything about how and where your customers drink bottle cocktails?
No, not really. I mean, our design, I know you have it in front of you, can come across as what quite simplistic. And why that is because, you know, when people brought out RTDs, it was almost artisanal in the expense that they had gone to the bottle design, the label, and you almost felt guilty in opening the bottle. What we wanted to do is we wanted to create something that is simple, eye-catching, and you don't feel guilty about throwing the bottle out when you're finished. So that was our approach there. Remind me of the question again. I went off on a little tangent.
It was about how and where they drink it, because
now I remember. So the design aspect of the bottle, I feel like leads it to be drank wherever people want it to be drunk. I think the majority of it is drank at home, and but what we found is we're getting a lot more requests now for 500 ml formats that we do, but for events and also for weddings. So where the bartender needs to serve 400 spicy margaritas in a reception of an hour slot, you know, having a bottle that fits five serves and just pouring it over ice because you don't need to shake or stir versus actually having to shake every single one, double strain it, garnish it and send, it's a lot more time saving. So to be honest, I think the great thing is that ours is drank anywhere.
It's really important because there's a liquor store actually in my building downstairs from where I am now. And we're two blocks from Central Park. And the weather's getting nice here in New York City now. So they do a roaring business in what you and I would call a nip, right? A 200 ml bottle. You know, they sell wine, they sell other things, but they sell a lot of canned and bottle cocktails because the people, the young, predominantly young, will go buy a bunch of them. They'll go to Central Park, they'll drink them, they'll walk out of Central Park, throw them in the trash and walk home.
Yeah,
there's no stirring, there's no shaking. And that's actually, in terms of bottles or canned cocktails, that's cutting into what was traditionally the territory of beer and wine.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think as well, in that format as well, that's kind of also why we choose bottles, because we knew market research before we launched the brand with a company here in London. And what we found is that your intellectual creatives are probably the ones that are going to drink your product most. And they are the ones within that 25 to 40 year old bracket that actually don't want, what we found in our market research is they actually don't want 100 mil formats, because these are people that tend to have dinner parties tend to go to parks in large numbers. So they want to be able to buy one bottle where it has five serves versus having to buy five individual cans.
Right.
Yeah, so that's why we have gone with this format, because I get a question a lot of the time, which is like, why haven't you chosen cans?
Yeah, I mean, it's also a branding thing. There's something about glass. It's endlessly recyclable. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful. There's some amazing glass packages out there. And let's be clear, it's also a callback to the ingredients in all your cocktails, which is distilled alcohol. It's spirits.
Yeah. And as well, with that bottle in front of you, you can stick a speed pour in it and pour into a jigger.
You could, easy, in theory, jigger it. I think it's too late for that now. But and do people, when they visit the bottle shop, which mm-hmm. is in Islington as well, do they like come into the bar and hang out? Is there seating? Is there?
Yeah. So the bar is inside is 18 covers. So I've always wanted to do, obviously, the previous bar I had was 120 capacity. So I think it was withstanding. So I've always wanted to do something more intimate and more smaller. So the way the bar is laid out is we have an L shape frontage, and that L shape is ceiling to floor glass, and that's broke up with just shelving for all the bottles. And then as you step in, we have two poser tables that fit two foretops, and then the rest of the covers is around the bar. So it's small, intimate. It actually doesn't even feel like it doesn't, even though we're called a bottle cocktail shop, it's more bar led than shop. It's just that we have an RTD brand behind us. So yeah, when you walk in straight away, you know it's a bar. So I mean, it's a beautiful thing. The way it works is Monday through Wednesday would be, the split would probably be 70-30 bottle sales to bar sales, and then from Thursday to Sunday is 90% bar sales to 10% bottle sales. And that 10% of bottle,
for a little place, like, do you take people's phone number if they, there's no space for them? Is there a wait list, or is it first come, first serve?
First come, first serve. We do a few little bookings, but it's first come, first serve. But the beautiful thing coming into the summer now is we also have a terrace that our terrace is 22 covers. So our bar actually doubles in size coming into the summer. So we actually have 44 covers or something around that in the summertime versus the winter, where we only have 18 covers plus standing inside. And we're like, we showed the Six Nations during the winter. So it does be nice and cozy with 35 people in there with standing and seating, and people love it. And then you have what we were talking about earlier. You have that buzz of just people chatting and the environment, and when you can feel you're in a nice cozy bar. And then when we lose the covers of the terrace during the winter, that's bolstered by our online sales for the RTDs. But then there's a whole side of the business that's not consumer facing, which is our strategy. So we sell our bottled and keg cocktails into bars and restaurants that don't have a cocktail program, that want to have a cocktail program. And like the big boys do, if you choose to go on kegs, we will sign you into a minimum volume contract. So we're guaranteeing X amount of volume per year. And then, yeah, at the end of this year, we hope to hire a BDM, and then we just hope to continuously grow. And then once we do that, we'll potentially look at a second site here in London, and then, yeah, hopefully go further afield.
And do you find that people who come in and have a few drinks typically buy some bottles to take home as well?
Yeah, 100%. And it works two ways. So for example, right behind Point Station, well, behind every station, we have a freezer, obviously for the glassware, but at the bottom of the freezers has all of our RTDs. So if somebody orders a classic cocktail that we already have bottled, 100 mil gets poured straight from the bottle over ice and garnished. So what that does is that actually reinforces the brand and reinforces the RTDs that, yeah, these are bar quality because they're even serving them in the cocktail bar. And 9 times out of 10, when somebody is actually sitting outside or sitting on the posers, they actually don't see that we've poured it straight from the bottle. And we ask them, how was your drink? And they're like, oh, that was amazing. And then we reinforce the RTDs by going, that was actually come straight from one of the bottles. 9 times out of 10, people are like, oh my God, really? And then that leads to a bottle, 10 times out of 10, then that leads to a bottle sales. But in terms of like a brand's perspective, we were speaking about listings earlier on. 9 times out of 10, when you're in a busy bar or a guest is in a busy bar on a Friday, Saturday, and they drink gin, they're looking for the gin cocktail. They're not reading Beefeater, Tanqueray, They're not really reading the listing. But with us, because there's that small, intimate cocktail bar and you're surrounded by a wall of bottles and booze, they'll be like, oh, what did you say the gin was in this again? And we'll literally go over to our selection of gin, take the bottle down and actually show them it. So they're literally getting a physical listing of the bottle there in front of them. And then they're usually like, can you add that to my tab before I leave? Yeah, no problem.
Giving them not just liquids, but a story, an experience.
Exactly. Like, yeah, it's something different.
I mean, one of my old bosses, he used to say, one of the elements of a bar is story. You have to give people a story to take home, to tell other people, their friends at home, their family the next morning, the people around the water cooler. I mean, I just texted you. There is a bottle cocktail in New York. You can see the picture,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it's actually class.
Yeah, no, it actually came up because you said it was 17 seats. That's about the capacity of the amazing bar Shinji's here in New York City. Everything is, you know, chilled with liquid nitrogen and whatever. And the bar manager, John, he said, hey, Phil, can you drop us down a bottle of Old Duff soon for R&D? And I'm like, absolutely. And he said, can you send me a headshot as well? And I was like, okay. So this is now the cocktail. You can't see it because it's an audio podcast, but it's the branding and color of a breakfast oats brand in America. This is like Rice Krispies, right?
Holland and
Oats. With me, it's a delicious kind of a twist on an Aperol spritz. And they've only had it on the menu for about 2 weeks, but apparently 100% of the customers who aren't industry people is like, who the fuck is Philip Duff? Because it actually says it on the back of the label as well.
I love it.
It's amazing.
I haven't had it myself yet. Oh, no.
I have not.
It looks great. I've actually just sent you back some photos of the venue there, so you can actually get more understanding of what the layout is like and how the bar works.
Oh, that's much more bar-centric than I thought it was. I thought it'd be like, you know, a little bar in the corner of a liquor store. It looks fantastic. A venue before, or what was it?
No, it was literally a shell. It didn't even have as much as a wired light. So literally got it from ground up and worked with the designers. And I said to them, I was like, look, where is light and airy in terms of where you see the bottles? I said, I want that to be a little bit industrial. That's why you have the wooden shelves and the metallic. But I said, as we come into the bar, I said, it needs to get warm and dark and cozy. So that's why you have the black walls in the background. You have the wood paneling on the roof, which brings down the height of the roof, and then also you have the wood paneling on the pine bar top, and then that staircase then actually leads up to our production area, which is on the first floor. So it's kind of almost like, you know, where you have working microbreweries, it's a working RTD shop or a bottle shop, but even though, as you can see, it's predominantly bar-led. But then upstairs is where we do all our production. We do everything in-house in 250 bottle small batch runs.
Yeah, but there's something about that, about, you know, I've been in that, you know, there's famously 14 different pub licenses in Ireland. There's a license for a pub that's also a post office. There's a license for a pub that's also a shoe store. That's like a category of license in Ireland. And again, downstairs from where I live, there's a great little craft liquor store, and the owner opened next to it a craft beer store. And then about 6 months ago, he rejigged the craft liquor store. It's the craft beer store. It's still a craft beer store, but now it's got an 8-person bar, 8 seats at the bar, no standing. You can have a neat Amaro, a Mezcal, or a whiskey, or any of the beers, or a nice soda water, or a non-alcoholic. And it's the most amazing place. It's become like, you know, my Cheers. Because
awesome.
You're in a bar and yet you're in another environment, a shop in this case. But I think that's something really cool. Again, it's an experience. And that's the most valuable thing that you can sell people, because that's the story that they'll tell. Everybody needs stories, because everybody has Instagram and TikTok and Facebook and all that kind of thing. Everybody needs content, but most people are shitty content creators. So if you can give them a good story, that's it.
Yeah, I think you're right. And as well as like the age we live in, nearly everything has been done. So if you have, even if you do something that has already been done, but it's your own story, a story will resonate with somebody. And that's the best marketing you can have, which is your story.
Well, that's it. like those people also get to do something that it happens sometimes with wine tasting rooms and happens with craft beer breweries, but it hasn't really happened with spirits for a long time, which is you go there, you do your thing, and then you leave with an actual physical reminder, a bottle in your hand, something that when you tell the story to somebody else, you don't just tell the story, you show it to them. Maybe you even drink it together. That's a remarkable thing.
Yeah, and when you're drinking it together, they could potentially be telling you about the experience that they had when they were in the bar, which now they're actually, you might think yourself, you're having that experience at home because, hey, you're getting this bar quality cocktail from a bottle and then reliving someone else's experience that they had within your venue, which then is hopefully is going to resonate with this person that's never been there before. And then they'll come try you. So,
yeah, but they'll definitely tell somebody else about it, no matter what they do. And that's really, really important.
Yeah, fingers crossed we can bring it over to your side of the world in the next few years.
Well, the US is an interesting one. Like, you don't get to do as many partnerships with brands as you've been able to do. They're all a bit terrified, actually. So you tend to see the brands bringing out their own cocktails, possibly working with the American equivalents of yourself behind the scenes. But
yeah.
The idea of an independent one is still a little tricky. But hey, everything's possible. And what the pandemic has done is it's got everyone who wasn't already American, used to drinking cocktails at home, used to making cocktails at home, which was never a thing. America had prohibition. The rest of the world did not.
Mm-hmm.
But we all had the pandemic. And suddenly everybody from Fiji to Australia to South America was getting on Zooms, learning about how to make cocktails, reading cocktail books. So what you have with Cocktail Bottle Shop is the logical extension of that.
Yeah, and I think as well like you said, there is an awful lot of RTD brands on the market in the US, where versus the UK, it's not really even a trend yet, but it's starting to go that way with the likes of the Bottle Cocktail Shop, the White Box brand, Black Lines. Like, these are the three brands that are potentially leading the way within the market over here. Obviously you have Mott as well, but I can just see this market over here just getting bigger and bigger. Because if you look now, especially when you turn your eyes down to Australia, RTDs have just been such a thing over there for the past 5, 6, 7 years. Even when you go to some bars, you get an RTD served straight away. You don't even get a shaken or stirred drink. So it's just showing what us bartenders can do.
I mean, in Australia, it's been 30 years. Like, at one stage, largely because of the Jim Beam and Coke in a can, it was 50% of the profits for the Jim Beam bourbon brand globally before bourbon took off again not so long ago.
Oh, wow.
It's wild. And they're used to it. Like, they're used to grabbing a can of a cocktail. I mean, it was probably 10 years ago. I was in a rock and roll hotel in St. Kilda outside Melbourne, and they had kegs of Absolut espresso martinis that they bought from the Absolut vodka distributor in Australia.
Wow.
So they were all set for that. Well, look, we could clearly go on forever here,
yeah,
but it's definitely cutting into your happy hour. It's deep in the afternoon here in New York City. So tell us, how can people find both you and the shop and its delivery service online?
Yeah, so to find the shop, just www.thebottlecocktailshop.com, or just look us up on Instagram at The Bottle Cocktail Shop. And yeah, you'll see everything we do, from behind the scenes of making the RTDs to our cocktail creations in the bar. So yeah, go check us out. Right now, we are only delivering within the UK, but we're slowly working behind the scenes to deliver further afield. So we're currently talking to some courier partners like DHL. So hopefully we can get something sorted out soon. And to find myself, just at Kieran_BCS. And that's where you'll find me.
You're going to have to spell Kieran. Not everybody knows how
that's spelled. Yeah. So Kieran is very Irish and it's spelled the Irish way. So CIAN_BCS. There we go.
Brilliant. Mr. Smith, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.